This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Latin American update, fallout from Venezuela's sham elections, a look at results of the first round of presidential elections in Colombia, and a preview of Mexico's upcoming ballot. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro cruised to victory in an election derided as a farce by the United States and other countries, capturing nearly 68% of the vote to just over 21% for his chief rival, former governor Henry Falcon. But Venezuela is sliding deeper and deeper into crisis, hit by hyperinflation, an economy that is nearly 50% smaller than it was in 2013, and the exodus of hundreds of thousands of nationals spilling across the borders into neighboring countries. Oil production is now 1.4 million barrels a day, down from more than 3 million barrels a day in the late 1990s. Food and medicine are in short supply. The overall contraction of the economy is the biggest in the history of Latin America. And in Colombia, Iván Duque, a protege of former President Álvaro Uribe, took the most votes in the first round of presidential elections by pledging to bring order and improve a sluggish economy while strongly opposing neighboring Venezuela's authoritarian government. Duque is a U.S.-educated lawyer who worked at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington. He wants to slash regulations and taxes while rewriting parts of the 2016 peace pact that ended the conflict with the FARC rebel group. Gustavo Petro, a former Bogota mayor and ex-guerrilla from the long-defunct M19 movement of the 1970s and 80s, came in second, garnering 25% of the total vote. The two will compete in a June 17 runoff, pitting two sharply different politicians to lead a resource-rich nation that is also a U.S. ally in the war on drugs and a bulwark of stability in Latin America. And if time permits, we'll also preview Mexico's elections and the status of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, currently under renegotiation. Well, with us for our periodic Latin American update are our two distinguished analysts. Eric Farnsworth is Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society. That's a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs here in Washington. And Eric Olson, he's Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and that's a prominent think tank also here in Washington. And the two Erics join me at the VOA Broadcast Center here in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Eric Farnsworth, quickly first to you about the Venezuelan election. Most people consider it a sham. It's an election in name only. Does any country recognize these results? And what's the upshot?
Well, some countries do recognize the results. They are Venezuela's closest allies, like Cuba, and some of the countries like Russia, which are, for their own purposes, seeking to support the Maduro regime. But the upshot is that Venezuela has shown its true DNA now in the context of the Maduro regime. It is no longer in any way democratic, and it's a country that has barreled toward international pariah status increasingly, and I think this election has really been the final element of that. So that everybody could see the true colors, the true nature of the Maduro regime. So I think going forward, the legitimacy of the government in Venezuela is very, very much in question.
And Eric Olson, anything to add or subtract to that description of the results?
Well, just to add that one of the reasons we call it a sham election is because the government imprisoned several of the big politicians, disallowed many of the opposition politicians from even running, as control of the Electoral Institute or the Electoral Body. So it's just not a cliche. I mean, there's a lot of substance to what Eric is saying, that these are sham elections because of the way it was run and orchestrated by the government.
There was a lot of talk about a possible challenge by Henry Falcon, but even that fell way short.
Yeah, many of the opposition people in the country refused even to participate. And Falcon is a former governor, as you mentioned, former member of the Socialist Party who broke away. There were a lot of questions of really the legitimacy of his own candidacy. And so it wasn't even a competition between real opposition and the government.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. I tried to give a sense of the dire economic and humanitarian straits in which Venezuela finds itself, but give us a sense of this humanitarian crisis.
It's hard for those of us in the Western Hemisphere to truly comprehend the severity of the crisis because these things don't happen normally in Latin America or in the Western Hemisphere. We're more used to humanitarian crises in other parts of the world, which are tragic and terrible, and it's taken the world a long time to recognize the severity. What are we talking about? We're talking about fully one-third of Venezuela's population is now outside of Venezuela, many of them desperate refugees crossing the border in the thousands every day into Colombia and into Brazil and into the Caribbean islands, desperate for food, desperate for basic medical care, sick and tired of having their kids go to a school, which is nothing more than an indoctrination by the regime. So these are people who recognize that they have no future in Venezuela and who are leaving. Meanwhile, common diseases which have been eradicated for years in the region and certainly in Venezuela, which at one point was Latin America's wealthiest country, have made a return. Diseases like malaria and cholera and other things that have been put to the side for many years have now come back. It's a total collapse of the social safety net. It's a collapse of society as we know it. And the only people that seem to be doing particularly well these days in Venezuela are those that are either part of the regime, whether in the military or security forces or part of the national energy company, PDVSA, or somehow part of the government itself, or those who manifestly offer support for the regime. And this is one of the most insidious issues in terms of the elections that we've just been talking about. Many people who did vote, and there are many who didn't, of course, but those who did, many of them seemed to be concerned that if they didn't, the regime would know about that and would take their jobs away and would refuse to give them their monthly food supplements and other access to medicine. So the regime is actually using food and medicine and other basic things to control its own population. It's not just a humanitarian tragedy. It's really something that we have not seen in the Western Hemisphere. It's a dystopian society.
Very sinister. Yeah. Turning back to you, Eric Olson, this was once Latin America's most prosperous nation, now in ruin, a collapse of society and the social safety net, as Eric described.
Yeah, that's the big tragedy. I actually grew up in Venezuela. I was there in the 1960s and 70s, and I didn't realize it at the time, but you're right. It was the wealthiest country in the world. It had the world's most stable currency, if you can believe that. To this day, it has the world's largest oil reserves, and yet the government is so inept and it's, you know, mismanaged so badly that it can't even get that oil out of the ground and to market. As you pointed out, the production is down significantly. So there are many issues here that are just so tragic. They're tragic in every country. But for those of us who know and love Venezuela and knew Venezuela back in that time, this is, you know, doubly tragic. I just wanted to add one more thing to what we said. This is a humanitarian crisis, yet the government refuses to acknowledge it. The UN, the World Food Program, all these programs could be there to help Venezuelans, and yet the government refuses to acknowledge it. And that, too, in my mind, is immoral and criminal.
It refuses to acknowledge and also refuses and actually caused the crisis in the first place. Yeah. So they're not only caused it, and they're now refusing to allow others to help try to fix it. So it's doubly insidious in my view as well.
It brings to mind Syria, like Bashar al-Assad. All he's not doing is killing his own citizens with snipers and barrel bombs. But anyway, let me turn now to what the international community is or is not doing. Eric Farnsworth, what has been done to sanction the regime, and what more can the international community do to further isolate Maduro and his thugs without simultaneously further hurting the Venezuelan people?
It's a real balancing act. The international community is very, very aware of the things that they could do, but they are also aware of the things that they don't want to do to put the Venezuelan people in greater harm's way or to lessen their circumstances in some way. There's a distinction between the government and the people. Certainly there's a desire, as Eric Olson was saying, to try to help in the context of greater humanitarian assistance, whether outside the country or to the extent the government allows it inside Venezuela at some point. But at the diplomatic diplomatic level, at the level of other nations, a lot is being done, not just to sanction individuals, which has been done by the United States and by Canada and by Panama, by Switzerland, by the European Union, others, and I think more of that will continue, particularly now that the elections are out of the way, but also to show the delegitimization of the regime. So we saw, for example, at the Summit of the Americas in Lima, Peru in April, a very strong stand by a number of countries there condemning the actions of the Maduro regime, asking them, frankly, to postpone the elections or cancel them in some way. We've seen steps taken just immediately after the elections to further sanction individuals from Venezuela. We see the OAS General Assembly in early June likely taking additional steps to either suspend Venezuela's participation in the OAS or at the very least to call continued attention to the fact that this is not just a humanitarian crisis, but now this is also credibly accused of a country that's having crimes against humanity. And we're going to hear a lot more about that and possible referral of the regime to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So there is a lot going on at the international level. Much of this takes time to develop the case, whether at the legal level, at the political level, and it takes time to coalesce. But I think over the coming weeks and months, we're going to see a lot more activity along those lines.
What do you say, Eric Olson? I mean, condemning, imposing sanctions on this man-made humanitarian, political, economic disaster is one thing, but is this enough? And what is the end goal? Because we see Maduro continuing to get away with his depredations.
I think there are two things that kind of hold people back. And I agree with what Eric says. It's important to continue to isolate and to sanction, as the United States has done. But there are two things that kind of hold the international community back, unfortunately. One is no one wants to be in charge of a failed Venezuela. I mean, they don't, you know, the United States doesn't want to be the one that has to rebuild Venezuela. There's only so far people are willing to go in that process. The second thing is something that Eric alluded to earlier on, and that is you have extra-regional players such as Russia who have their own agenda. So in a perfect world, the international community would come together and sanction and create enormous obstacles for Venezuela. But in this instance, you have a country like Russia who's not interested in that, who's rather interested in making life difficult for the United States and the region. And so they play this second game that's difficult to get them on board with this kind of sanctioning.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth. He's Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Eric Olson. He's Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're discussing the fallout from the Venezuela elections and examining soon elections in Colombia and Mexico. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Shehu Ibrahim, who forgot to tell us where he lives. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Don't forget to tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Let's move on now to the elections in Colombia. We witnessed the first round of presidential elections. And as I said in the introduction, Iván Duque, a more conservative candidate, he's a protege of former President Álvaro Uribe, is going to face off with Gustavo Petro. He's a former rebel. What did the results from this first round of elections tell us about the direction of Colombia from the current situation with President Juan Manuel Santos?
I think the first thing that needs to be said is that Colombia ran a free and fair and clean election. And we compare that to what we've just been talking about in terms of Venezuela. The contrast couldn't be more stark. So this is a country, Colombia is a country where democracy is strong. It is a polarized society, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But in the context of support for democracy, I think that it's basically unquestioned, and that's a very, very good thing, and it's a testament to the Colombian people. What the results show, I think, is that Colombia is divided. The two candidates who will be competing in the second round to become Colombia's president on June 17th, Iván Duque and Gustavo Petro, represent different sides of the political spectrum. And the defeat, if you want to put it that way, in Colombia during the elections was for the middle, more of the centrist candidates who couldn't find a way necessarily to coalesce into one common view, and so they divided the vote, and so Duque and Petro were able to take advantage of that. Without projecting projecting who's going to be the winner, because that's always a dangerous game. Nonetheless, Petro has a lot of baggage in the context of being very closely affiliated with the rebels who were defeated in the field and signed a peace agreement with the government. And the Colombian people, I think, are still very skeptical about the role of the left in their politics going forward. So that's going to be something that we're going to have to watch very carefully. And that has real implications, of course, for Colombia's direction going forward economically, with relations with the United States and a variety of other things.
Turning to you, Eric Olson, for your take on the results of this first round of presidential elections in Colombia.
Well, one of the things that's interesting here is that traditionally Colombia has been viewed as a pretty conservative country. And I'm not saying that as a negative or a positive. It's just politics has been center and center right. And that's been the competition since the murder of a leftist leader in 1948 that unleashed all this years of civil war. This is the first time where you have a national figure clearly from the left participating in elections, representing a legitimate option for people. I'm not predicting he'll win. It looks like he probably won't win. But he does represent something that there hasn't been much of in Colombia over the years.
Gustavo
Petro. He was the mayor of Bogota, the country's largest city. He was successful. He was liked. Again, it's not to suggest that somehow Colombia is swung far to the left or anything of the sort. But I do think as a political scientist and an observer, it shows that there has been some real maturity and change in the overall public attitudes in Colombia. Maybe they will elect Iván Duque, who's more of a conservative and a traditionalist. But things have shifted in the country. And I think in a general way, I would say that's positive for democracy in Colombia.
How do we characterize ideologically the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, who is constitutionally barred from a third term? Where does he fit on this spectrum?
Well, I think you'd get a variety of opinions on that question if you asked a variety of Colombians. Probably not for me to answer as an outsider, but he came into office 8 years ago essentially promising to continue many of the same things of his predecessor, President Uribe. And he struck a far more independent course, both economically and also pushing through the peace agreement with the FARC. And he was rewarded with a Nobel Prize for that. And in part, that is one reason why the candidate Iván Duque has done so well, because there has been a bit of a backlash against the Santos government and what some in Colombia perceive as too lenient of a deal that was given to the guerrillas. And so that's all playing into the current result.
Quick follow-up. Is the FARC agreement, this peace accord, do you think it's too lenient? I mean, what do you make of Mr. Duque's decision to rewrite it? He wants to rewrite it. Is that even possible? Does he want to scrap it? I mean, what are the implications of his position should he win?
The peace agreement is being implemented. It's been imperfectly implemented, but I think except for the most extreme elements from either the left or the right in Colombia, most people would agree that that's the path forward for Colombia. It's not really for outsiders to say. This is something that the Colombian people themselves have decided they want to do. But having said that, it is complicated because you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. And so by bringing folks who have been fighting against the Colombian state into the legal political process, as Eric Olson was saying, yes, that is a march forward for democracy, but it does also require a fair bit of forgiveness and goodwill from the population at large. And that's something that I think is still developing among the Colombian people, and it will take time in any peace process, whether it's South Africa or whether it's countries around the world in other places. And so that takes time. Those wounds are deep, and they have to heal. Meanwhile, there's a lot of resources that are required, frankly, just to implement the peace accords and to meet the conditions and the terms that were spelled out for alternative development, job creation, infrastructure, all of these things, government services that really hadn't existed in some of these areas in the past. That's expensive. That takes a lot of money. And so the next president of Colombia is going to be faced with not just a sluggish economy, but the needs to fund the peace agreement and also now to deal with the number of Venezuelan refugees coming across the border into Colombia. The Colombians certainly haven't budgeted for that. So where is this money going to come from? That's going to be a real challenge for the next president.
So, Eric Olson, we know that Gustavo Petro supports the FARC peace agreement, but say he doesn't win and Iván Duque does, and he's questioning the peace agreement. He says he wants to rewrite it. How do you see the fate of this FARC peace agreement? Do you think it's working so far? Does he have legitimate concerns? What are your thoughts?
So the question is, do you want to rip it up and try to start over? I suspect nobody in the FARC would be interested in such a thing. So I think the risk is that you create an environment where people return to conflict, and that's a big problem. There's a second smaller guerrilla group known as the ELN. They have been toying with peace discussions on and off. And should they rip up this peace process, I think it would be a huge disincentive for the ELN. The question Colombians have to answer is what do they want in their future? Do they want a future where there's reconciliation, where there's peace, where there's some attempt at justice so they can move on? Or do they feel that the issues that drove the conflicts are not settled and so they have to continue that conflict? And I think the choices are pretty clear.
And it does seem to be a bulwark. The process was fair, as you said, Eric Farnsworth, the electoral process, and it's a very strong ally of the United States in the war on drugs. Can it play an important role to mitigate the disaster of Venezuela, whoever comes on top on June 17th?
Absolutely. If the Colombians want to, they certainly can. And they'll probably be forced into a more robust response in any event, just because the crisis deepens by the day. But Colombia has proven to be a very strong and valued ally of the United States. But Colombia is also doing some things which are very interesting globally. They are exporting expertise in terms of security. And in terms of other things to Central America. They were allies in Afghanistan and the Middle East. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on that the Colombians have provided globally as well, to the point where Colombia was just invited into the OECD, and that's been a long-term goal of the Santos administration. And they have also been named as a special partner for NATO, which is ironic because the North Atlantic Treaty Organization doesn't extend to Latin America, or at least it hasn't really to this point.
In the few minutes we have left, let's briefly turn to Mexico, Eric Olson. Elections on July 1st. Talk about what's at stake in these elections and how that may relate to the United States.
Well, what's happening in Mexico is actually quite surprising, maybe even shocking to some, because the candidate who is far and above ahead in the polls is really an outlier in the sense that he does not represent a traditional political party in Mexico. He broke away from the ruling party. He was in another leftist party. He's created his own personal movement more than a political party.
And what is his name?
His name is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's often referred to as AMLO, A-M-L-O. He's charismatic. People call him a leftist, but he really is a reflection of Mexico and Mexico's exhaustion with corruption, with the failing of traditional political parties. Mexico had its most violent year on record last year with 30,000 murders. It's got huge problems with corruption. It's dealing with, let's be honest, almost a hostile government to the north, which is the United States. And that also has created pressure within Mexico to stand up to Donald Trump. This idea that Mexicans are going to pay for a border law is just deeply offensive to Mexico, and that has political implications for Mexico as well. And NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA has been something that Mexico has grown to rely on. They view it as very important. And for Trump to throw the door open and make what they considered unreasonable demands has really impacted them as well.
We probably don't have a lot of time to talk about NAFTA, but you get the last word, Eric Farnsworth, with respect to the upcoming elections in Mexico and what's at stake.
Well, what's at stake is the direction of Mexico for the Mexican people. The choices are clear, in some ways, much like what the Colombian people are facing. And I agree with what Eric Olson was saying in terms of the candidates and the likelihood of directional change there. The question I would have is, what can the United States do to bolster that relationship? And I think the foundational piece of the relationship between the United States and Mexico is NAFTA, as well as Canada. And so you're building that North American relationship. To the extent that goes away, whether because the three parties can't agree on an updated negotiation or because one of the leaders of the three countries pulls out or some other iteration, to the extent that NAFTA does not continue, you take away those guardrails of the North American relationship that even during difficult times have helped channel the policies of all three governments in a certain direction that's ultimately mutually supporting.
All right, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll bring you more on news from Latin America in the coming weeks. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, and Eric Olson, Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Gentlemen, as always, thank you. Gracias for coming in, sharing your insights.
Our pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.